and the one we're getting from Thanksgiving.
And that's because it's driven by younger people who are more.
Hi, this is Terry Manning, and you're listening to 90.7 FM, WGXC Accra.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by Mid-Hudson Cable, serving Columbia, Greene, and southern Albany counties with digital cable, high-speed internet, and cable phone services for homes and businesses since 1971. Mid-Hudson Cable, all the right connections on the web at mhcable.com.
Wave Farms WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of J. Johannes Froebel Parker of Ravenna, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
Do you have some news to share with WGXC listeners or a special community event you want everyone to know about? You can send press releases on any subject to news@wgxc.org, where they will be shared with all WGXC reporters, hosts, and programmers. Anyone can also add an event to the WGXC calendar online at wgxc.org/event. Just go to wgxc.org/events and click on the Add an Event button at the top of the page and type in the information about your event. WGXC announcers read these events on the air throughout the day, and internet readers can access them anytime. So please let WGXC listeners know when you're making news or when you have an event to share with your community.
Well met, well met, said a no true love.
Welcome to Movies on the Radio on WGXC 90.7 FM, Accra, Catskill, Hudson, radio for open ears. Movies on the Radio is a weekly simulcast accompanying the Philmont Media Project's outdoor film screening series, Sidewalk Cinema, at 100 Main Street in Philmont, New York. You're tuned into our monthly radio showcase of the sounds of experimental cinema and experiments in sound from artists, filmmakers, and makers of all stripes in Columbia and Greene counties and across the world. This episode, we're exploring the life and legacy of filmmaker, musicologist, painter, ethnographer, graphic designer, mystic, and collector of string, Harry Smith. On screen now, we are looking at film number 2 by Smith, who we'll be spending the hour discussing with our first in-studio guest and my colleague and neighbor at the Purpose Makerspace, Anthony Irwin. Anthony, say hello.
Hello. Hello, Heath.
Thank you for coming in.
It is my pleasure.
So we are going to be spending the next hour talking about Harry Smith, his legacy to the world of cinema, to the world of American music, and to American culture more broadly. You want to talk a little bit about how you became familiar with Smith?
Yeah, well, to be honest, the first time I heard Smith's name was from you, Heath, when you said you were going to do, and I didn't know who he was. But then when you said that he was the person who compiled the Anthology of American Folk Music, then I knew exactly who he was, or at least I knew his work, because I know that anthology really well. As I think a lot of people who are interested in folk music, early American music, and have a pulse in this country. So then I was intrigued, and then, you know, I did like one night of sort of digging around and looking, and I sent you a bunch of emails with a string of like a New Yorker article, a thing about From Dust to Digital, and some other info. And the more I heard about him from you, the more intrigued I was.
Yeah, I had a sort of similar experience. I thought he was two separate people. I came across to Harry Smith, you know, in my dissertation days, you know, learning about American underground and experimental film. And I also just happened, you know, to be into folk music and knew there was this anthology and, you know, Harry Smith, a common name. And it was like a bolt out of the blue when I realized they were the same guy. The connections between his film work and his work as a musicologist and an archivist weren't initially obvious to me. But as we've both kind of been learning about him and his life, there's some really interesting things there to discuss. And he's sort of a great topic for this radio program, right, which is exploring a visual medium in a sonic medium. And he really worked with sound and visual art in ways that are intensely interconnected. So I'm hoping we're going to get to talk about some of that today. But I thought we might kick off our show and our discussion of Smith's life with a selection from the Anthology of American Folk Music. And so what do you say? Should we introduce it or just cue it up and then discuss?
Why don't we read the liner notes to it?
Ah, yes, yes.
So why don't we do that for every track, right? We can read what Smith wrote in his I think, like, famous and genre-setting liner notes that came with the Anthology of American Folk Music. Then we can play the track and then have our little analysis and discussion about it.
Fantastic idea, yeah. You want to do the honors?
Sure, I'll do the honors. So this is number 34, Indian War Whoop, Country Dance, F. Ming, by Floyd Ming and his Pep Steppers. Violin with two guitars, auto harp, stomping and vocal sounds, recorded in 1928. Original issue, Victor 2.294A 4:896. The effect of pre-Columbian America on contemporary music has been chiefly to act as a catalyst between European and African musical elements. It is doubtful if this recording bears such real relation to, quote, Indian music. It is, rather, romanticism akin to that of, quote, Western movies. The pre-steppers, drumming of feet, is a type of performance seldom heard outside of religious music. All right, so...
All right, so let's listen in to Indian War Whoop from Harry Smith's Anthology of American Folk Music. Thank you. All right. Hoyt Floyd Ming and his Pep Steppers.
There's some pep in my step after
I was
going to
say, yeah. There's a lot of pep in my step after that one.
But maybe that's because I brush with Pepsodent. This episode of Movies on the Radio brought to you by Pepsodent.
I'm expecting a check.
a Chexodent.
So I think we both have an association between that song and a movie, but it's not a movie by Harry Smith, right?
No.
Probably, if a lot of our listeners are familiar with that song at all, it's from the film Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
By the Coen Brothers.
By the Coen Brothers.
Happy Hanukkah, by the way.
Oh, that's right.
To the Coen Brothers and all other members of the tribe.
Happy Hanukkah, indeed.
Yes.
So the Coen Brothers arguably introduced or reintroduced this song to the American popular consciousness. But I think it's fair to say that without the work of Harry Smith, the even Oh Brother, Where Art Thou would have, I'm not going to say it wouldn't have existed, but I think it would have come from a more impoverished cultural memory. We know so much more about that time and place in America thanks to the archival and preservation work we owe to Harry Smith, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Especially when you say like we, I think just in like the general populace of America. Of course, there would probably be ethnomusicologists and specialists who would know about the history of early recorded music in America. I mean, it's not exactly super early. This is, most of the stuff is from the 20s. But the anthology of American folk music being in people's homes, being a product of six discs that people could buy and listen to, it set the stage for the folk revival that came in the 60s that Oh Brother, Where Art Thou just comes directly out of. I mean, we can draw a direct lineage from that.
Right. And so when we decided to kind of pick that as our opening track, it being possibly one of the more familiar tracks on the anthology. But I think we did have a little conversation about, you know, is this song, you know, is this a politically incorrect song? Is this cultural appropriation? You know, it's not truly an Indian war whoop, if such a thing is even a thing. It's probably not. But as we kind of tried to answer that question, I think we learned that Smith actually had some very deep roots and deep connections, and his artistic practice itself is marked throughout his career by deep connections to certain indigenous peoples' religious and cultural practices.
I mean, that's interesting given what he writes in the liner notes that we read before we played the song, where he says that, you know, any kind of resemblance this would bear to any actually Native American music would be romanticism, like the way that Western movies are romantic. And I think that, you know, there's definitely something to be said for that. But I think lately there's been a growing acknowledgement and attention turned to the impact of Native American indigenous music on American popular music, on the blues. I mean, there's that PBS documentary called Rumble, which talks exactly about that. And that documentary is sort of the arrow of that documentary points at rock and roll. Mm-hmm. And Rumble, right, is a Link Ray song. Link Ray, who was a Native American or had Native American ancestry. But in that documentary, it talks about the earlier sort of intercultural mixing of, you know, mostly Western African enslaved peoples and later Native American people and European colonialist settlers, and the way that American music, blues, early jazz, country music sort of comes out of this melting pot of culture, or crucible, I guess you could say, of culture. And in that, you know, in that documentary, there's this one really amazing part where they talk about Charlie Patton, who's a Delta blues singer, guitar player, was also most likely a Choctaw. And the way that the rhythms, what they call like the four on the floor rhythms from Native American music and a certain type of singing mixes with this West African polyrhythm and European, I think, melodic sentiment in certain regards to give us things like Delta blues.
Right. And in this case, I mean, what genre would you call, I mean, this particular piece of music. I'm not conversant enough in these styles to put a name on it.
I mean, I don't know. It's a fiddle song. They're playing the fiddle. I don't know. And that's a problem. There's a problem with genre itself. It's definitely like, I think this is on, we're not going to talk about the organization of the anthology yet, but this is under, is this one on Social Music?
This one is on...
Oh, no, yeah, I think it is. It's on Volume 2, Social Music.
Yeah, Social Music.
So it's like a dance, you know, this right. is for getting down and partying. And it sounds, you know, puts pep in your step.
It does. So let's kind of connect that conversation up with Smith's early life. So he's born in 1923 in Portland, Oregon. And he has some parents who sound interesting, which is probably an understatement. They were intensely interested in the occult and theosophy.
Like everyone's parents.
Right, yeah, these days. Secret societies. He claims that when he was 10 years old, his father gave him a blacksmith shop and instructed him to begin researching how to turn lead into gold.
No pressure, though.
Well, I want to put a pin in it because I want to come back to this idea of alchemy because I actually think the alchemical metaphor is a way to kind of understand Smith's whole project, but I don't want to get ahead of ourselves because there's another important connection, which is that Smith's mother was a teacher at a Lummi Indian reservation outside of Bellingham, I think. And through this connection, his mother had, Smith began spending a lot of time observing, documenting, and then ultimately participating in a lot of the rituals and indigenous practices of not just the Lummi, but the Swinomish and the coastal Salish peoples all up and down the American Pacific Northwest coast. And by the time he was in high school, he was spending months, you know, his whole summers in these native communities, and he collected sacred ritual objects, and he began making recordings on 78, usually on acetate or shellac discs. And he also began his first sort of staggering attempts at transcribing the steps and the spoken dialects of the people he was spending time with. And I think out of that, we start to see the emergence of Smith's interest in representing sound visually. He said he was engaging in an effort to write down the dances of the native people. He claimed to have developed certain techniques of transcription, and that's where his artistic career started. It was an attempt to write down the unknown of Indian life, as Smith put it. And he actually was such a sort of gifted amateur ethnographer that he began working with anthropologists at the University of Washington and even corresponding with Franz Boas, who I think is pretty widely regarded to be the sort of the founder of modern anthropology. So he's a precocious young guy who has a gift for observing a culture other than his own. So at the same time, Smith is conducting all of these enterprises in amateur ethnography. He's also becoming an obsessive record collector. And it's important to note that he's doing this, he's in his teenage high school years during the Second World War. So he's keenly aware that the available extant records are all being melted down to produce shellac for the war effort. So early on, you have Smith sort of racing to rescue from obsolescence these artifacts of American culture. Maybe in a way that's akin to his awareness that, you know, the native peoples and their practices were also, you know, rapidly vanishing from the American landscape. So there's an archival preservationist instinct from the very beginning in the different kinds of things Smith is interested in.
And that collecting of records to save them. I mean, you mentioned about this exploration of visual representation of movement and sonic life, but also the kind of materiality of sound mm-hmm. as well. I mean, that, I don't know, it could be sort of, what's that, like teleological, like I'm thinking like materiality of sound is really important now because it feels ephemeral mm-hmm. with digital media. So to think back on him collecting these records, I guess that was just what was done. But now, the archive that he collected was very much a material thing. It was heavy. It took up space. I'm just thinking about this because I have a record collection as well, and it's a pain to move around the world. Which he did, as we'll get into, right?
Yeah, his record collection and you know, the people who knew him, particularly when he lived in New York, we're talking about people like Allen Ginsberg, would remark on just the insane amount of things he traveled with. And he was kind of an itinerant, you know, bohemian guy. And everyone, you know, he carried around canoes with him and literally like tons of vinyl and shellac records. I don't want to use the word hoarder, but, you know, you get the sense that he had a complicated relationship to the things in his life. So by the time he's done with high school and World War II is ending, he decides to relocate to the Bay Area. He moves to Berkeley, and according to Smith, he goes to a Woody Guthrie concert and smokes marijuana and starts going to see weird art films at the San Francisco Museum of Art. And this is where, in 1947, Smith actually premieres his first film. He would tell later researchers that he was making films as early as 1939, but there's no evidence to suggest that was actually the case. So why don't we go now to the Sidewalk Cinema screen here at 100 Main Street in Philmont, New York, where we'll be putting up Smith's film number 7, which is one of his earliest films and which premiered at the San Francisco Museum of Art in 1948. So Smith's films had no fixed musical score often, although they were intensely related to music. The San Francisco Museum of Art actually commissioned then contemporary jazz musicians like Dizzy Gillespie, Charlie Parker, and Chet Baker to come in and respond to the art films they were bringing in from the nascent American art cinemas, and as well as sort of more established European avant-garde filmmakers. And here we're thinking of people like Oscar Fischinger, who listeners might be familiar with if you've seen Fantasia. The wonderful abstract sequences in that film are actually by the German expressionist artist and filmmaker Oscar Fischinger. And he is one of the people who Smith cites as a major influence on his film practice. So Smith was seeing his films there, as well as being introduced to the world of early 1950s, late 1940s jazz.
Yeah, I was just going to say that this film reminds me of Fantasia, and I thought that would be a real like Philistine sort of comment. I figured you'd
Oh,
be
not
like,
at oh. all. No.
Because that's what it looks. I mean, that's I guess my only reference for this. You know, if you want to describe the aesthetic of this film, it's sort of that washed out. I guess I would say early 50s, but it's what, 49, you said?
Yeah, the late 40s. Smith is working. I mean, Smith was working on these for years, so. To describe these films, they are, in fact, hand-painted. Smith didn't have access to a camera, but he was very, very interested in attempting to visually represent music. So he was inspired by, actually, an Indonesian textile printing technique known as batik.
Batik.
Batik?
Batik.
Okay, I've never pronounced it before. So in batik, wax or some other sort of impediment to the dye is placed over the fabric.
Yeah, a resist. It's called a resist.
The resist. Yeah. That's right. Using this technique, patterns are able to be printed on a fabric. So Smith is working with clear celluloid film and stencils, jellies, light filters, and meticulously, laboriously creating abstract images, very geometric, very colorful, improvisational, but I would say highly structured. I don't know. It's a challenge to describe it to you, dear listeners.
To me, it's windows of filtered colored light opening and closing in geometric patterns that sort of set off explosions and their neighbors to respond to them. Like the images are sort of choreographed in a specific way. And I can't help but think about, yeah, about jazz and that, especially that late 40s, early 50s kind of jazz.
Yeah.
Where maybe it, to me, it's like these images that are coming up, these different shapes are being produced by different musicians, different players, something like that.
I like it. By all means, if you're in Philmont or nearby, come pay us a visit at 100 Main Street, our outdoor sidewalk cinema, where we are screening the films of Harry Smith this evening. Smith claimed to experience true synesthetic connections between, you know, film and music, between his visual art. And we should say he was also a painter. Most of his paintings are either in private collections or have been lost or destroyed. But Smith thought that his paintings were vastly superior to his films. So we have a few remaining examples, but most of his painting work is no longer available to us, unfortunately. But Smith does have a recollection of seeing Dizzy Gillespie play for the first time. And he claims to have literally seen all kinds of colored flashes. And he said it was at this point, seeing Dizzy Gillespie experiencing American jazz, that he realized, you know, music could be put into his films. And I don't think he meant, oh, we can put a soundtrack to my films. He believed that, you know, a film could actually contain music. And so Smith begins to, you know, kind of develop a small name for himself in San Francisco. And he actually wins the patronage of the Guggenheim Museum. And at their behest, and in an effort to get closer to New York City to experience their jazz scene and to meet artists there like Marcel Duchamp, Smith decides to move to New York City. And this is where his career really begins to intersect with some more of the music we're going to be looking at tonight. Because he arrives in New York, he's broke, and he's looking for a way basically to cash in on this enormous record collection. He's touring with him everywhere. And he approaches Moses Ash of the, I think, still relatively new then Folkways Records, trying to, you know, offload part of the archive to him. And Ash declines to a wholesale purchase of the collection. But he challenges Smith to curate a selection of songs. And it's this selection of songs that eventually becomes the Anthology of American Folk Music. It's released in 1952. And it's a pretty genre-defying mix of 84 tracks, spanning, you know, Appalachian music.
There's gospel, hillbilly music, blues,
thank you.
Cajun music, and I guess, you know, what at that point he was also collecting what they called race records, and I think the as you said, genre-defying. Not defining, mm-hmm. right? He didn't really care so much about genre, I don't think. And the way that he organized the anthology doesn't have much to do with genre itself. It has more to do with the message of the song, when the songs would be used by people. Like we said, there's, you know, one is called social music, which includes everything from Cajun dances to gospel music that would be sung by choirs. Basically, mm-hmm. just people making music in groups. And so that was that. I think also we get more of his sort of anthropological bent on how he organizes these things, and maybe not his ethnographic bent, because he's not breaking these up in the liner notes. You know, it doesn't say, Mississippi John Hurt is a black man, blah 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 blah.
Right.
And this is black music. It's just, this is a song, you know, or this is a ballad or whatever. And I think that's also one of the great gifts of this anthology is that it doesn't rely on a lot of times the synthetic division of genre that was perpetuated by record companies in the early centuries, kind of splitting music and musicians into hillbilly music or race music, race records or Appalachian music, and instead kind of showing it as one great sort of orchestra or cacophony.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and one of the other great things about the collection is, as Smith points out, these were records made in the late 20s and early 30s, before the country was really saturated by any kind of national media forms, before the radio was in everybody's home, and before everybody was, you know, basically before things like the radio and the cinema flattened the American cultural landscape, flattened the forms of vernacular expression, and Smith preserves these, you know, and so there is this diversity, you know, on the cusp of kind of being smothered, that Smith is able to grab up and capture here and in all these songs. And he does really, really, as we've said, defy the categorizations that would have been imposed on them by what was an emerging, I don't know, what some people would call the culture industry, you know, that is interested in commodifying these things and marketing them.
Smith, which we are members of.
Which we are definitely members of. But Smith is an attempt, in a way, capturing a more innocent, a more culturally innocent moment in our relationship to media. One of the things he says is remarkable about a lot of these performers is that they were able to, once they heard recordings of themselves, they would modify their singing styles and their playing styles, so that the act of self-awareness itself changes the music. And Smith was looking to capture records that, you know, were that had yet to happen. And I think it's one of the really precious things about the collection.
Yeah, and what a small sliver of the existence of recording media that would be the case on, that people like, we'll get into like the Carter family, you know, traveling to lay down a few tracks for some record producers, had never heard themselves before. So those first tracks that were laid down, or Mississippi John Hurt that we're about to get into, you know, in 1928 he lays down his first record, that could only really happen once before people start hearing themselves. And especially with the Carter family, right, then they become really, really famous. Mississippi John Hurt is another story. But yeah, that idea that the medium allows for this small little moment where naive is the wrong word.
Mm-hmm.
It's just virgin, I guess, a virgin sort of.
It's sort of unself-reflexive, you know? Unself-conscious.
Yeah, it's like something that can't be re-achieved, I guess. Yeah. It makes me think about my friend. I remember my friend talking about when people learn how to spin yarn.
Mm-hmm.
There's a big demand for the first skeins of yarn spun by someone who's never spun before, because you don't have the fine motor skill to really control the sort of shape and width of the yarn that comes out. So it's irregular in a way that people who have spun yarn before can't replicate.
Huh.
It's like trying to make it's like trying to make art like a child, where the marker, you can't really hold the marker in your hand. You don't have the fine motor skill. But I don't like that. I don't like bringing it to like a child, because it's not that these people making music were like children.
Mm-hmm.
It's just they didn't have an experience of this medium and this technology before.
Right. Well, why don't we throw on the Carter family as a way to kind of explore some of the stuff we're talking about here, and to start to sample some of the wide range of diverse musical styles Smith was able to assemble here.
Sure. Yeah.
So we're going to play
John Hardy, right?
John Hardy by the Carter family. Let's cue that up.
All right, you want me to read the liner notes?
Oh, that's right, liner notes. Okay, so why don't we read the liner notes for John Hardy by the Carter family, and then cue that song up.
Okay, 17. John Hardy was a desperate little man, A.P. Carter, by the Carter family. Vocal solo by Sarah Carter with auto harp and guitar, recorded in 1930, original issue Victor, 40:90A. John Hardy held without bail after gunplay. Girls in red and blue visit jail, wife at scaffold. No absolutely authentic information is available on John Hardy, except the order for execution on file in the courthouse at Welch McDowell County, state of West Virginia, versus John Hardy, felon. This day came against the state by her attorney and the prisoner who stands convicted of murder in the first degree. The prisoner saying nothing, why such a sentence should not be passed. It is therefore considered by the court that the prisoner John Hardy is guilty and that said John Hardy be hanged by the neck until dead on Friday the 19th day of January 1894. Witness of the trial states that Hardy worked from the Shawnee Coal Company on one payday night, killed a man in a crap game over 25 cents. And then that's the bibliography. I'm not going to read the bibliographic information.
Okay, so let's jump right in. So that was the Carter family, who's probably familiar to many of our listeners. What can you tell us about this one, Anthony?
Well, I think something important to mention is the guitar technique that Sarah Carter kind of uses there, what becomes known as like the Carter family scratch, mm-hmm. which if you heard it, she's plucking out the melody on the bass strings and then sort of like scratching down to play the rest of the chord. On the higher strings, so it's a way of accompanying oneself with just a six string guitar, and you know the idea it's been recognized that this method of guitar playing most likely was taught to Sarah by a man named Elsley Riddle, mm-hmm. who was a black man that A.P. Carter and the rest of the Carter family, you know, were friends with, and A.P. Carter and Elsley Riddle traveled around the mountains of Virginia and Tennessee, collecting songs, learning songs from people who lived up there, and then they would bring them back, and they would record some of them, alter a lot of them. I think Elsley Riddle also wrote a good number of the songs that the Carter family wound up recording. I think my favorite of which is the Cannonball Blues.
That's a great one.
Yeah, I love that one. You know, this song is from, what, 1930, right? But, but as I mentioned before, I think their first recording was done in 27 in Bristol, Tennessee for Victor. And it's, yeah, they left their like cabin and went to the city, went into a room and laid down some tracks. And then from there became really well known.
So let's go from the Carter family, this sort of, you know, exemplar of, you know, Appalachian folk music, to another song that's illustrative of just the wide range of musical and racial diversity that you know is on the anthology. Who do we have next?
We got Mississippi John Hurt with a song called Frankie, which is one of my favorite songs. I realized that we don't have the liner notes for this one, so we'll just listen to it.
All right, let's put it on.
Frankie was a good girl. Everybody knows she paid $100 for Al one suit of clothes. He's a man, and he done her wrong. Frankie went down to the corner saloon. Didn't go to be gone long. She peeped through the keyhole of the door, spied out within Alice's arm. He's my man, and he done me wrong. Frankie called Albert. Albert says, I don't hear. If you don't come to the woman you love, gonna haul you out of here. You's my man, and you done me wrong. Frankie shot with Albert, and she shot him 3 or 4 times. Let's throw back, I'd smoke him a gun, let me see his Albert dine. He's my man, and he done me wrong. Frank and the judge walked down the stand, they walked outside the side. The judge says to Frankie, you're gonna be justified. Killing a man, and he done you wrong. Dark was the night, cold was on the ground. The last word I heard Frankie say, done laid old Albert down. He's my man, and he done me wrong. I ain't gonna tell no story, and I ain't gonna tell no lie. Well, I would pass about an hour ago, a girl you call Alice Pride. He's your man, and he done you wrong.
All right, that was Mississippi John Hurt's song Frankie, which was recorded in 1928 on the first album that Mississippi John Hurt recorded. Like a lot of musicians from that time, Mississippi John Hurt recorded these tracks. He didn't become famous, unlike the Carter family. And then the Depression basically just made it so that he didn't record tracks again for a really long time. He went back to being a farmer. And it wasn't until the early 60s that he was found again. So 52, the Anthology of American Folk Music comes out, and people hear this song Frankie and they're blown away by it because it's an incredible song. It's from 1928, but it's just as palpable, the emotion in the song of this woman scorned Frankie at killing her husband, as it was in 1928. So eventually Mississippi John Hurt is found by these folkies in the 60s, and they basically bring him, he plays in Newport Folk Festival, he records a bunch more albums before he dies in 66. Pete Seeger brings him on his television show, and he's celebrated as an American hero. And I think that really shows the power of the impact of this Anthology of American Folk Music, that it's not like Mississippi John Hurt died after he recorded that song. He just had to work.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the 60s, when the folk revival happens, himself and a number of other artists who are represented on the Anthology of American Folk Music are found and basically given careers.
Not only that, but they wind up being the foundation, as you said, for the folk revival movement. But I mean, without this anthology, it's an open question to me, at least, whether or not we have Pete Seeger or Bob Dylan or, you know, any of the music they went on to inspire. So it's a really different cultural landscape without this anthology. Maybe we can jump into one more song to sample some of the diverse sounds on here. What do we want to play?
I thought we were going to do John the Revelator, right?
Let's do John the Revelator.
Yeah.
And we'll come back and we'll look at one more of Harry Smith's films and go from there.
I'll read the liner notes.
That's right. Yes, please.
52, John the Revelator by Blind Willie Johnson. Vocal duet with two guitars, recorded in 1930, original issue Columbia. Who's writing? John the Revelator. Who's John writing? About revelations. Daughter of Zion, Judah's lion, Moses to Moses, God redeemed, brought us with blood. Moses saw bush, book of seven seals. No information is available on Willie Johnson, one of the most influential of all religious singers. Most of the 30 or so sides he recorded for Columbia were made in New Orleans, so that city may have been his home. The recording given here, with alternative lines into the chorus by a different singer, is typical of his middle period recording. Many of the tunes he first recorded in the 1920s were later recorded during the 1930s by the Carter family, Blue Sky Boys, Carlisle Brothers, and similar groups. So just quickly before we play the song, you know, Blind Willie Johnson was a highly evocative figure, I think, and people wanted to know a lot about him. There's this part in this recording with another Blind Willie McTell in 1940 recordings, where they ask Blind Willie McTell what happened to Blind Willie Johnson, because nobody knows. And Blind Willie McTell says that he's dead. He says that they were friends, and he got a letter from his wife that Blind Willie Johnson is dead. And then I think it comes out later that he actually wasn't dead. but just, I love the Blind Willie to Blind Willie networks that existed amongst these musicians.
Well, all right. Blind Willie Johnson, John the Revelator.
Well, who's that riding?
John the Revelator.
Who's that riding?
John the Revelator.
Who's that riding? Hey, book of the seven, tell me what's John riding? What's John riding? What's John riding? Hey, book of the seven, father who bow away, has cried a holy, bound and folded, son of our God, daughter of Zion. Good at the line, he redeemed the sin that bought us with his blood. Tell me, who's that riding?
John the Revelator.
Who's that riding?
John the Revelator.
Who's that riding?
John the Revelator.
Hey, book of the seven. Well, what's John a riding?
John the Revelator.
What's John a riding?
John the Revelator.
What's John a riding?
apricot, the step on his heels. I'll unravel later, great advocator, catch them on the battlement's eye. For telling the story, rising in glory, cried, Lord, to the love of Samaya, tell me who's that riding?
John the Revelator.
Who's that riding?
John the Revelator.
Who's that riding?
John the Revelator.
Hey, forgot the step on me. Well, what's John the riding?
Master Revelator.
What's John the riding?
Master Revelator.
What's John the riding?
Master Revelator.
Hey, forgot the step on the field. Well, Moses to Moses, watching the flock, saw the bush where they had to stop. God told Moses, pull off his shoes, out of the flock, go where you are shoes. So tell me who's that riding?
John the Revelator.
Who's that riding?
John the Revelator.
Who's that riding?
John the Revelator.
Hey, for God, the well, what's John the riding? What's gonna
riding? Master Revelator.
What's gonna riding?
Master Revelator.
Hey, for God, the step on the field. Well, who are we? Elders cried a holy, bound and fold the son of our God, daughter of Zion, Judah the lion. He redeemed us and he bought us with his blood. Tell me who's that riding? Who's that riding?
John the Revelator.
Who's that riding?
John the Revelator.
Hey, for God, the step on the field.
Heath, do you want to tell us a little bit about the importance of the liner notes that came with the Anthology of American Folk Music that Smith put together?
Sure, yeah. So in addition to having all of this musicological information in there, there's a bunch of really fantastic original artwork by Smith. And at the same time the anthology comes out, Smith begins working with collage in his film. And the film we're about to see is going to be an example of some of that work. But the collage style, again, really tracks with Smith's interest in bringing together ephemera with the mystical. So he combines images taken from the Sears Roebuck catalog with images from 17th century alchemical texts. And if you have a chance to look at the anthology, you might see a picture of this enormous stringed instrument descending from the heavens, being tuned by the hand of God. It was called the Celestial Monochord, which positions the anthology within Smith's broader interests in the mystical and the occult.
Awesome.
Before we go to look at one more of Harry Smith's films, I want to read a quote I have here from Ronnie Singh, who is the director of the Harry Smith Archive. He wrote that the Anthology of American Folk Music was a modernist collage in sound and image, a dark and mysterious panorama of America. The anthology offered firsthand accounts of trials and travails, assassinations, loves lost, and burdens found. Smith's collection uses the wisdom of the country's marginalized populations to portray a distinctly American experience in all its oddity and complexity. Using vernacular music as raw material, the anthology presented a previously unexplored cultural history of America. And as we load up Smith's film number 11, I want to think about that, about Smith's work in total, anthology and his films, as expressing this dark, mysterious, marginalized America. And I want to connect that back to Smith's lifelong interest in alchemy. Because alchemy, we all know, all right, it's a pseudoscience, but at its core, it's about elevating the base to the precious. And I think that's what so much of Smith's project has been about. It's been about finding the ephemeral, the strange, the weird, the not perfect, and transmuting it into something else, elevating it into creating, in a way, what we have come to know as the American folk music tradition. It's something forged by Smith in his rescuing of the debased, the marginal. And it's something that I think is really, really magical about his work, but I also think it's what makes him a truly important, you know, if criminally underappreciated American artist. So to kind of leave off on ideas of the mystical, of the alchemical, and of collage itself, I want to turn now to Harry Smith's film number 11. And why don't we throw on another song, too? What do you want to go out on, Anthony?
White House Blues.
We're going to go out on White House Blues by Charlie Poole and film number 11 by Harry Smith at the Philmont Media Project Sidewalk Cinema.
Says McKinley, I can't find that long buffalo to Washington. Roosevelt in the White House, he's doing his best. Killy in the graveyard, he's taking his rest. He is gone.
Well, Anthony, that's it for this episode of Movies on the Radio. Thank you so much for joining us.
It was really my pleasure, Heath. Thanks for having me.
And thanks to all you listeners for tuning in to another episode. We'll be back next month and the second Thursday evening of each month with more sounds from the world of experimental cinema. Meantime, you can check us out online at philmontmediaproject.org. That's Philmont with an F. Or find the Philmont Media Project on Facebook or Instagram, where you can see some more images of Smith's work and stay updated on the Philmont Media Project's programs and workshops. If you have comments or questions, or if you are a moving image maker based in the Hudson Valley and would like to share your work, you can contact us at philmontmediaproject@gmail.com. Movies on the Radio and the Sidewalk Cinema are productions of the Philmont Media Project and are made possible in part with funds from the Decentralization Program, a re-grant program of the New York State Council on the Arts, with the support of Governor Andrew M. Cuomo and the New York State Legislature, administered in Columbia County by Create. Tonight's event was broadcast live on Wavefarms WGXC 90.7 FM, radio for open ears in New York's Upper Hudson Valley, made possible by Wavefarms Transmit Partner Program. Tune in online at wavefarm.org/listen and on the Wavefarm radio app. Philmont Media Project is a proud member of the Purpose Cooperative Makerspace in Philmont, New York.
That's Philmont with a PH.
That's Philmont with a PH.
Look, hey, you rascal, you see what you've done. You shot my husband at Ivy Johnson gun. Get mad to Washington. Docked on the horse, he tore down his mane. Said to that horse, you got to outrun this train from Buffalo to Washington. Dr. Andrew Randy shaked off his specs. Said, Mr. McKinley, better pass in your chair.